Hello, writers. I'm Grant Faulkner, and I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, today, our featured guest is Matt De La Pena. And one thing that I find interesting about Matt is that unlike most authors who tend to be bookworms from day one, he wasn't a reader as a kid. For a variety of reasons, which we'll explore, he just didn't see himself as a reader, and he didn't have many reading influences in his life. In fact, he didn't become a true reader until he went to college, and he essentially became an accidental reader there. He went to college to play basketball on a basketball scholarship, and he was the first member of his family to ever go to college. And it was only through chance that he became a reader after a professor of his gave him a copy of The Color Purple and said she wanted him to read it sometime before he graduated in the next 2 years. And he, you know, says, sure, I can read that sometime in the next 2 years. But that ended up being a great tease, because somehow the challenge of having to read a book in the next 2 years made him read it right away. And he was swept away and essentially became a big reader right then. And so I'm curious, Brooke, this just makes me think of all of those potentials that are in people and that just need the right invitation to come out. And I wonder if you've discovered a latent talent or interest that emerged later in your life, or if you know of other similar stories where someone is a somewhat unlikely artist because they didn't grow up doing their art, or they didn't grow up being encouraged to do their art. Suddenly you have access to it and the door opens.
Right. Well, I've talked a bit on the show about my piano playing, which I can hardly call a latent talent, but it is a latent commitment. And it's something that I'm doing completely for myself for completely personal reasons, and, you know, that I gave up as a child and came back to. So in that way, I can relate to it. And yeah, it would have been really cool if I had turned out to be, you know, like a 40-year-old prodigy, but that is not what's happening. When you ask me, do I know of any stories? I actually thought of Julia Child, because her story is interesting. She wasn't any kind of chef until she enrolled in France's École de Cordon Bleu when she was 36. And so she hadn't grown up a foodie. She didn't come from a family of gourmands, but she certainly found her passion and eventually, of course, enormous success. And so it's inspiring to think about someone like her, because I actually do fantasize sometimes in a remote kind of way about jumping ship. And what would I do if I didn't do publishing? And what else would I be good at? What could I make a living at? So, you know, going back to Matt, I find it really inspiring, you know, even though we're talking about college, but it shows how our interests can shift, and they do shift, and that something that you might write off as not being important to you may suddenly become very important to you. And it's kind of the opposite conversation that we had when we interviewed Jeanette Walls, when I was saying that, you know, so many writers grow up in families that value reading and writing. And that was certainly true for Jeanette. And here we have a success story where that was not the case. And I am sort of thinking that it will give a lot of parents hope for those parents who have non-readers. And what about you, Grant? Any surprising secret latent talents you've been keeping under wraps?
Not that I know about, unfortunately, but I definitely don't have any stories quite like his. But I'm interested in those sides, and I often reflect on things that I've denied myself, that I've talked myself out of. And I think I've mentioned this before as well. When I was in high school, I remember thinking about starting a band. I was really into punk rock, of all things, which was an open invitation for those who kind of didn't know how to play the guitar to form a band and just do it. But I, for some strange reason, thought I was too old at the old age of 17 to learn how to play the guitar. So I gave up that notion. But at the same time, I also was very convinced that I wasn't a science type, and I pretty much stopped taking science courses. And I think this is really what happens to us. We tell ourselves we're not something, and we create a story that we then become. And I essentially needed a science teacher to challenge me in the same way Matt De La Pena's English teacher challenged him, because I rejected myself as someone who could understand science. I didn't allow myself to envision it. I'm writing a book on rejection, as you know, and I'm interested in self-rejection as part of that. And I recently read about Jhumpa Lahiri's journey to be an author. And what I found interesting was that writing was her vehicle to make friends when she was in grade school. She wrote stories with others in her class, and they would pass the pages back and forth and write their, you know, additions to the story. And when she became an adolescent, though, she stopped writing because of self-doubt, and also because she was more interested in being someone else than herself, as she put it. And this was part of her immigrant experience. She wanted to erase herself and to be another person. So she took up acting instead. And she said, How could I want to be a writer to articulate what was within me when I did not wish to be myself? And I've been thinking about that, about it's interesting to think about how being yourself, being comfortable with yourself and really seeking yourself is fundamental to artistic expression, or that's what I'm wondering. Do you feel this way, Brooke, that you need a strong sense of self in order to be an artist, or can one be a writer when fleeing yourself or erasing yourself?
It's a really powerful and deep question to ponder, you know, and I think what's true for one person is going to be not true for another, because the first thing that is coming to mind when you're talking about that is people who are grappling with a past that they're trying to make sense of. And so like both things are true. They might be trying to make sense of something that happened to them and then be drawn to the page almost as if it is an obsession. And I actually have a story of someone like that, because when I was in Kauai, I sat on a panel with the mystery writer Anne Perry. And Anne has written an extraordinary number of books, literally like something like 70 or 80 or more titles. And Anne's story, which she doesn't speak about publicly, but it's out there on Wikipedia and, you know, everywhere, was that she was convicted of helping to participate in the murder of her friend's mother when she was just a young teenager. And she served time for that. She got out, she changed her name. And she's become this incredibly sensitive and thoughtful writer of mysteries. And I thought of her for obvious reasons, but one of the most primary topics that she returns to in her work over and over again is redemption. And on the panel I was on, she posited to the crowd as to whether a person should be judged for a single act. And it seemed so evidently a question that she was mulling over about her own life. You know, and I, of course, have no idea whether Anne has wanted to flee or erase herself, but I could only speculate that the themes that she writes about in the prolificness have to do with this reckoning of her own life. And certainly, you know, the life that she's carved out for herself, it seems to me to be all about, you know, writing to make sense of this experience that she had.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this question, and I wonder if the desire to cover yourself up or flee yourself holds interesting avenues for expression as well. I hear performers talk, and actors and comedians maybe especially, say that their performances were a way to escape themselves. And I'm thinking of someone like Robin Williams or Steve Martin in particular. But I'm wondering, or I'd argue, that the escape could also bring them closer to themselves at the same time. So we're always kind of on that seesaw. And I feel like if you're uneasy with yourself, I guess that it's going to be harder to be bold and vulnerable on the page. You're just going to question yourself too much. You're naturally going to take more risks and go further into your stories if you're actively pursuing your truth at any cost. And we see that with Matt De La Pena in a scene where he got pressure from a bookstore chain that wanted him to cut, you know, a scene from a picture book that he'd written, and Matt argued to keep it, which is, you know, tough to do. And he argued to keep it because of the reasons the bookstore chain wanted to cut it, because it showed a possibly tough scene for young kids. And I think it's unlikely that you'll have those arguments with yourself or with others if you don't cultivate a strong sense of self. So Brooke, I know, especially since you work with memoirists, I bet you've worked with plenty of writers who aren't pushing far enough on the page. You have an extra layer or two of truth and vulnerability, and they might not even realize it. How do you coach those writers you work with to be strong enough to fight for their scene, in effect, to seize their story?
Yeah, it's an important question, and I am glad you raised it. One of my favorite poets is David White, and he writes about the radical edge, which I've written about as well, and applying it to memoir in particular. And here's this quote from David that I love. It says, "One of the great temptations of human existence is to base your life on contingency, that you will actually take the courageous step once all the conditions are completely and utterly right for you. When you have the right boss, when you have the right job, when the car payment has been made, when the kids are through college, when you're on your deathbed, when you are dead, it will certainly be easier then." And, you know, this quote speaks to the urgency of creation on the one hand, but he's also explicitly talking about that one courageous step. And I think the courageous step is about much more than just writing, especially where memoir is concerned. Courageous is being vulnerable, is writing the thing you're afraid to write, is mining for deeper truths and new layers of self-understanding and understanding the broader world. And so I also encourage memoirists, all writers, though, you know, to be mindful and to exercise self-care, because writing like this, and this is more unique to personal writing, but it can be a lot like purging. And so writers I've worked with have pushed themselves too far sometimes, to the point of even making themselves physically sick. And I say this because, or share this rather, because both things are true. Like, you want to walk the radical edge, to go out as far as you can without falling off, but you want to do it in small doses and also with support. So to go back to your question of a few quick tips, number one, take a class or find a supportive writing group or a coach. Number two, write without worrying about publishing or who might read your work in the beginning, because that will help you avoid self-censoring. And then number three is to write the hard stuff, like trauma writing, with a timer on. And don't do more than 15-minute sessions at a time, and take breaks.
That's great advice, Brooke, and I love that notion of the radical edge. I like to think that the urge to be a writer is a generous act at its core, just because we want to share our stories with others and to give them a world that will hopefully open doors to insights and flights of the imagination. And the only way to do that is through an openness of spirit, and that can feel dangerous, though. And so my definition of a good story, actually, though, occurs when an author travels or even falls into the depths of vulnerability and genuinely opens his or her soul in the search of truths that otherwise go untold. And, you know, I think that my favorite stories are the ones where that's noticeably in effect. That's noticeably what the author is doing. Telling such a story, though, is certainly challenging, one of the most challenging things a writer can do, because we have to be vulnerable. And I think a lot of us are told, you know, kind of conditioned not to be vulnerable in our lives. I think the concept of the radical edge kind of helps us get there and to realize that being vulnerable isn't a weakness. It's quite the opposite. To tell your story in your way, to confront difficult truths and risk putting your story out there, takes courage.
I agree. So everybody, inch up to the radical edge with me for just a moment. And right before we fall off, we're going to cut to break. We'll be right back.
Brooke, so often I hear that people don't have time to write a novel, or that they don't have time to learn a new topic or pick up another hobby. But I've always found that we can make time for the things that are truly important to us. And that's one reason I'm happy that the Great Courses Plus sponsors Right Minded, because it makes learning super easy and accessible. Because it's this educational streaming service you can listen to on nearly any device, maybe any device.
Yes, that is so true. And there are literally thousands of lectures on practically any topic you can think of, tons on writing, but also games and math and space and the natural world, all with objective, in-depth information from some of the best teachers in the world. And the Great Courses Plus fits into your schedule, which means anytime, anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And the best part about that is that you don't have to make time to learn. That's my favorite part of Great Courses, actually, because time is my most precious commodity these days. I can listen to a course on a dog walk or on my commute, and I can stop, start, and rewind the course as necessary. I should also add that I've been listening to a course called George Orwell, A Sage for All Seasons, that I recommend. We started listening to it. I started listening to it with my daughter because she is reading Orwell's 1984 in class. So it's really cool for us to learn and talk about his ideas of individual freedom together, although I've been accused of being tyrannical at times.
It seems like a very pressing and important topic. And so I love that. I'm going to start listening to it too. And we hope that all of you will make learning part of your daily routine. And if you get the free trial that is on offer, you can also talk to us about what you think of the Orwell course. You can get that free trial of unlimited access to the entire library at the Great Courses Plus. And so, Grant, I'm going to have you say the URL in that way that you do.
Yeah. Everyone, get ready. Get your pencils out. Get your hands on the keyboard. Here it comes. The Great Courses URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. I'll repeat it more if you want.
A stunning job. Thank you for that. We'll keep it short and at that.
Good.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Welcome back, everybody. I'm super excited to have Matt De La Pena with us. Matt is the New York Times bestselling Newbery Medal winning award of 7 young adult novels, including Mexican White Boy, We Were Here, and Superman Dawnbreaker, and 5 picture books, including Love and Last Stop on Market Street. In 2016, he was awarded the NCTE Intellectual Freedom Award. That's National Council for Teachers of English. Thousands and thousands of English teachers awarded him that. And Matt received his MFA in creative writing from San Diego State University and his BA from the University of the Pacific, where he attended school on a full basketball scholarship. Matt recently moved back to San Diego, I believe, from Brooklyn, and currently lives in San Diego. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Matt, when I first met you, it was at the Young Adult Librarian Summit in Arizona a few years ago, and you gave a riveting talk on your early life and how distant you were from being a reader or a writer in your early days. And it was the kind of talk I wanted every reluctant reader to hear, and especially every boy to hear. And I was thinking about how most writers have a long list of favorite books they read as a child. You know, most writers were bookworms as kids, essentially. But you didn't read a novel all the way through until after high school, I believe. And so I was wondering if you could tell us why you weren't a reader when you were young and your relationship to reading as a young person.
Sure. I think it sort of goes back to where I was raised and how I was raised. I grew up in a border community in San Diego. And in this community, you know, I didn't see people who were reading, but more specifically, I never saw people who I looked up to, males, who were reading. This just wasn't part of the culture. So I just thought reading was a group that people like me didn't belong to. And then you want to magnify that. I grew up in sports. So I felt like I'd rather be out there doing than sitting in a room reading. So it was just a mindset. What I didn't realize is that I was reading the world. I just sort of hadn't translated that to the written word. However, all through my childhood, I was always writing spoken word style poems to try to figure out how I thought about things. So when I finally did discover the right books, I took to it immediately.
So, Matt, I know House on Mango Street was the first novel you read, and not only did you read it, you read it 12 times. And in fact, I saw a funny tweet from the NCTE conference where you said that you were told you should try another book, and you responded, "Why? I like this one." What did you like about that novel, and what would you tell a child who's reading the same book over and over and over again?
So I think what happens when you're a reluctant reader, you walk into a bookstore or a library and you just are overwhelmed by the number of choices, and you don't have any experience picking out a book. And you also might be like me, where you don't want to admit that you might not know what you're doing here. So when you do find a book that works, you kind of tend to read it over and over, or at least read that author over and over. I think there are so many young readers who have read every Harry Potter book multiple times, but they've never read anything else. So that is their comfort zone. When I picked up The House on Mango Street, I remember opening the front cover, reading the first vignette, and I thought, oh my gosh, it's like she's writing about my neighborhood. I felt like I had a place in that story, even though she was really writing about Chicago. And I was living in San Diego, but the rhythms of the language felt familiar. The characters felt familiar. And of course, the setting looked like my neighborhood. So I think it's okay to fall in love with a book to the point that you read it over and over. But hopefully you have somebody in your life when you're a young person who could steer you to something that's it's in the same territory, but it's an introduction to a new writer.
You know, on the topic of what kids should read, your publisher wanted, or one of your publishers wanted to remove a scene from your picture book, Love, where illustrator Lauren Long depicts a boy hiding under a piano and being comforted by his dog. And all the while, there are two adults arguing and a chair has been knocked over and a glass of liquor sits on the piano's edge. So it's not a typical scene for a picture book for a child. And the publisher thought a scene like this was too hard for kids to handle and wanted it softened, but you fought back and you fought to keep the scene included. And so I was wondering if you could tell a little bit about why you decided to fight for that scene.
Sure. The one correction I'll make though is it wasn't actually the publisher who didn't want that scene. It was a major bookstore chain.
Oh,
I won't name any names, but the publisher was actually really supportive, and they left it up to me and the illustrator whether or not we wanted to keep the scene in, even though we were getting major pushback by the industry. So here's the reason why I fought to keep it in. I feel like this is a book where we wanted to be as inclusive as possible. And I think publishing is doing a good job of changing what that looks like racially. So we're starting to publish more and more racially diverse books, but I think we're overlooking some other diversities, such as class and emotional diversity. So some kids are growing up in a happy home. The only way they see adversity on the page is reading about it. Some kids are under the metaphorical piano as we speak right now. And I think, A, it's important for those kids to see themselves reflected in a book, but I also think it's important for kids living in those happier households to know that there are kids who are under the piano. I believe that every child is going to encounter adversity. And I think sometimes parents, our instinct is to keep our kids away from adversity as long as possible. And, you know, that's a natural instinct. However, I think maybe the job of the parents is to not keep a kid from hurt and harm, but to hold them through it. And I think as a writer, I have the same mentality. Like, I want to be truthful about the world, but I want to do it while hopefully I'm placing you in a comfortable space.
And thanks for bringing up those other kinds of diversity, because you have labeled yourself a working class writer. So it's kind of talking about class issues there, both with regard to your family background and your approach to your daily writing practice. So can you share more about what that means to you to be a working class writer?
Yeah. So I've been in many writing groups, and sometimes I'm with really, really genuinely brilliant people. And there's one female writer in particular who I've always been in writing groups with. She's a genius. Sandra Newman is her name. She can write two drafts of a novel and it will be just wonderful. I'm not that way. I have to write many, 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 many drafts. If you saw a first draft of my work, you would think there was something wrong with me. how could they publish this guy? But I feel like it takes me a longer time to figure out what I'm doing, and I'm willing to put in that work. And I think what has inspired me to work that hard is watching my dad and my uncles go to work every day. They're not working with words. They're working with concrete or landscaping. However, they never took a sick day. They always put in the hours. They'd come home so tired, and I really respected and looked up to them for that. So I try to apply that same mentality to art. I think it was Toni Morrison who had this line, "I do not wait for a certain slant of sunshine to come through the window." In other words, I'm not waiting for that perfect inspiration. The best thing you can do as a writer is to sit in the chair and go to work and love that it's work.
Well, Matt, your novels come from the standpoint of being mixed race. You yourself are Mexican and white, and I'm curious how that informs your work, and it informs how your work is also received, because I know Mexican White Boy was banned in Arizona in 2012.
Yeah, so I think being a mixed person, it's very common. I think it's the highest growing demographic in the country today. But when I was growing up, it was like something that was unspoken. People kept it quiet. So you were kind of left to your own devices and how you're going to interpret what it means, figure out where you fit. And then, you know, I've also had this interesting, similar feeling when it comes to my background, as I played basketball in college, and you couldn't get further away from literature than college athletics. And then, of course, I found my way into an art. And I remember when I was playing basketball in college, I used to think of myself as an artist. And I thought, well, when I go to an MFA program, I'm finally going to be among my people and I'm going to truly fit in. But when I got there, I felt like the rest of the people in the program looked at me like I was a jock. So I kind of felt like I was not firmly positioned in either group, just like I feel like I'm not firmly in the position of being a white person or a Mexican person. So what I've found over the years, and maybe this is just what I'm telling myself, but I think sometimes when you are positioned on the margins of groups, you're in a better position to report, tell stories from, because you can see it from a different angle. So in a way, I think it's incredibly beneficial for storytellers to be sort of on the margins.
So I wanted to ask you about the recent scandal over American Dirt, which is about a white writer who wrote a migration story and got a lot of things wrong, to put it very simplistically. But I'm wondering what your feelings are about the own voices movement, and how do you think that publishing could do a better job to elevate writers of color and stop making the kinds of mistakes that we saw play out with American Dirt?
Gosh, this is just all over the news, isn't it? Everywhere I look, American yeah. Dirt, American Dirt. So I haven't read the book, so I feel like I'm not in a position to comment on the actual story and how well it's executed. But there's a lot of, especially Latina critics who are saying things that I'm going to trust, because I think they are in a great position to judge what they've read. So when I think of the Own Voices movement, I think, you know, it's important to really know the nuances of the character you're inhabiting. So one time when I was teaching a writing class, somebody really smart, young writer, young man, he was taking on the point of view of a Marshallese young person, I think maybe preteen. And you know, he had taught abroad for a year, and he was just moved by this culture and this environment. The very beginning of the novel, the character comes out and marvels at this landscape. And right there, you see a little bit of a crack in what he's trying to do, because this boy has only lived here. He comes out of his residence and he doesn't even see that beautiful landscape because it's the only thing he knows. However, the writer who's there and who's taken with this, because he's only been there a year, he notices it in a different way than the character. So I think that's a small example of getting the nuance right. For me, my rule for myself is I will never write a full Mexican character, because I don't think I could do it, even though my dad is full Mexican. So I concentrate on mixed characters because I truly know the nuance of what I'm doing. So I think it is possible to get it right. Some of my favorite books have been written by people who are not in the community they're writing about. However, I think they're getting it right. So I just think one thing you have to do when you sit down and choose what story you're going to concentrate on, or take the next few years of your life to execute, what is your motivation? Is it because it's hip to write about immigration today because publishers might be looking for that story? Or is it because this is something you have to write physically, even if it made no money? So I think motivation to me is a big factor. It's such an interesting topic because I think it's changing as we speak. Every year it becomes slightly different. And so therefore my opinion changes. I'm now a little bit more, I don't know, attuned to the fact that some voices aren't getting an opportunity to tell a story that they really know best. And I think some writers need to make space for that.
I love that guidance of examining your motivation as a starting point and really understanding what you want personally and for your reader. I'm curious in closing, you didn't self-identify as a kid lit author when you began your career. You studied, as far as I know, the kind of typical type of literary fiction that MFA programs offer at San Diego State. So I was wondering how you can, if you can tell us a little bit about that evolution into a YA and a children's book writer.
Absolutely. So I came out of my undergrad and I got into an MFA program. Everybody's writing adult literature, adult fiction. And I thought I was too. So I wrote my first book, Ball Don't Lie, originally titled Three Stones Back. I thought I was an adult novel, got an agent. And then my agent called me one day and he said, we have two offers on the book. One is from an adult publisher and one is from a YA publisher. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. I can't believe it. It was the best call I've ever received. And I said, who's offering the most money? And they said, the YA publisher. And I was like, done. Let's do that. And then he said, just so you're aware, it's going to be released as a young adult title. And I was like, fantastic. That's great. And then I hung up the phone and I had to go home and Google what YA was because I had never heard of it. So I think today writers are more savvy because YA is a bigger field and it has people are more informed about what it is. But when my first book came out, it was, 2005. So I think back then, YA was much more niche. We didn't really know what it was. So when it came out as a YA novel, I will be honest with you, when I first walked into the bookstore and I saw that it wasn't in the general fiction section, I was kind of heartbroken because I thought, well, you know, here's a book that I'd worked so hard on and I thought it was intelligent enough to be placed in among, you know, the general section of fiction. I think over the years I've realized that actually it's a great place for me because I've always been drawn to the coming of age story. You mentioned House on Mango Street. One of my greatest inspirations is the way Sandra Cisneros wrote that novel. So it's a good place for me. And now my goal is not to like join the general fiction bookshelves, but to raise the bar of YA. I think I've been reading a lot of YA over the past 10 years, and some of the canon of tomorrow is actually being written in the young adult field. So I think those writers who are trying to like strive toward literature in the YA field, those are the people who I want to be inspired by and follow. And then, you know, I never thought I was going to write a picture book. But what I realized is that the best picture books are just poems. And I had grown up writing spoken word poetry. So it was actually very natural to write a poem for the youngest readers. And now it's one of my favorite things to do is write picture books. So, you know, it's sometimes we have this perception of who we're going to be as a writer. And sometimes the market tells you that you're slightly different from what you believed. And, you know, we go with it. I think back to that. Is it okay to quote Eminem on this podcast?
Sure.
He has that great line, you know, I am whoever you say I am. And I think as writers, readers tell you who you are. And you embrace that and love that because we're, you know, it's such an honor to get to do this for a living.
Those are great words to end on. Thank you so much, Matt, for joining us.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, what a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back, folks, with Grant's Takeaway.
Hey, everyone. This week's takeaway is based on Matt De La Pena's phrase, a working class writer, which, you know, means different things to him. But one of the things it means is this just showing up and working every day and you know, embracing that working ethos that you have to bring to the page. And I've heard, though, you know, so I think sometimes people think you've got to be a 9-to-5 writer when I'm saying something like that, or a 9-to-at-least lunchtime writer. And I'd like to modify that. Because I think we all have to define what being a working class writer means to us. And, you know, this week in particular, I heard two different people. One person told me that she didn't know how to revise, and she was kind of at loose ends, you know, to the point that she wasn't even opening up her novel to think about what that could mean or how she could do it. And then, you know, here I hear this all the time, is somebody saying, I don't have enough time to write. And my question for especially the one person who said she didn't have enough time to write was if she could write 200 words a day, did she have 15 or 20 minutes a day to write? And if you do the math on that, 200 words a day ends up being, I think, something like 73,000 words a year, which is a very, very nice, big novel. And so that is one way of being a working class writer, is just to find those 15 or 20 minutes a day and to do it. And working every day builds into something big. It also, I think, helps you, you know, part of the theme of the show with Matt was how you can so easily talk yourself out of something. And I think this is a way to talk yourself into something by starting small, but to do it regularly and to have constancy while you do that. So hope this helps you be a working class writer.
Thanks so much for that, Grant. And thank you to all of our listeners. We so appreciate it. It is you guys who help us to continue to do what we're doing, and we're enjoying it so much. And we have all of these amazing guests. So we're looking forward to bringing on more. But one thing that actually really, really does help with visibility and with supporting us to get new subscribers and also possibly and hopefully some new sponsors is reviews and those little stars that you see. So if you would, please do. Grant and I appreciate it so much, and we'll see you next week.